Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Prasky. As scary as tornadoes can be, just imagine how the earliest settlers to North America felt about a phenomenon they knew nothing about. In those days, settlers would come across rows of flattened trees and wonder. They wound up calling them wind roads. The culprit wasn't viewed then as a natural phenomenon of cold meeting warm. Tornadoes were blamed on the Storm King, a mythological figure who galloped through the night amid bolts of lightning. In his new book, Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers, Lee Sandlin chronicles our fascination with storms and tells the story of the men who try to figure out just how tornadoes were formed. To set the scene this morning, let's listen to some 1991 tape as photojournalist Ted Lewis and reporter Greg Jarrett from Wichita's KSNW wrote out a tornado beneath a highway overpass. Here's what it sounded like.
Get up under the girders.
Is that where we want to go?
Yes. Underneath the girders. Keep rolling, Ted. It's coming out.
Okay.
Come here. Shove yourselves right up underneath them. And hang on to them.
It sounded like a freight train. It just passed right on top of us. People very upset. People underneath the girders of this overpass. They're still hanging on for their lives. It was a tremendous rush. Flying debris everywhere. Some people look to me like they're all right, but they have scratches and bruises. Here comes another one. Hang on, Ted.
Well, let me introduce author Lee Sandlin, who joins us this morning from Chicago. Lee, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
My pleasure.
And that's what it sounds like, I guess, as close as we may ever come to what it's like to be actually in the middle of one of those things. And just for the record, the National Weather Service does not recommend taking shelter underneath an overpass during a tornado. Does that make sense to you, Lee?
Yeah, that's actually really important to stress. That piece of video is famous.
Yes, it is.
Giving people the idea that an overpass is a good place to hide. And in fact, in the open country, it's about the worst possible place to hide because the wind passing under the overpass can actually speed up.
Huh.
So your best bet in open country is to look for a flat depression in the ground and lie flat on your belly and try to ride it out that way.
Hey, you also say that people shouldn't waste time, you know, if a tornado is coming towards your home, opening up windows, you know, that old tale about you want to equalize pressure. Why don't you want to do that?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this, and this is one of the things I was fascinated by when I started researching the book, is that advice about opening the windows has been around for more than a century.
Yes.
They actually came up with that in the 1880s, and there was never really any strong scientific basis for it. They had the idea in those days that the damage from tornadoes was caused by the difference in air pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So if you opened up the windows, that would equalize the air pressure inside the house as opposed to outside, where there was supposed to be a near vacuum, and that would keep your house from exploding, which is kind of an interesting idea, but in fact, it's complete nonsense. The area inside a funnel cloud does have lower pressure, but nowhere near low enough to cause that kind of damage. But the idea has been around for so long, people still think that's what you're supposed to do. A couple of the tornado people I talked to said, don't bother opening your windows. The tornado will do that for you.
You also point out there's no best corner of the house to sort of go wait it out in. I've always heard the southwest corner was the best.
Yeah, when we were young, it was the southwest corner was what I heard when I was a kid.
Yeah, right.
About 10 or 15 years later, they started saying the northwest corner. The truth is, and to give your listeners the most practical advice I can give them. In recent years, we've learned that almost all of the casualties caused by tornadoes are caused by flying debris. Not air pressure, nothing like that. It's debris being blown about by these incredibly high winds. So the best thing you can do is to get into a windowless room, somewhere away from windows, somewhere away from flying glass. An interior closet in a house, for instance, is great. If you can't get, if you don't have an interior closet like that, hide in a bathroom. Bathrooms, partially because the windows are usually smaller, and also because the piping in the walls gives you that much more protection. Get into the tub, draw something heavy over you, like a blanket or a mattress, even better. Anything that'll keep you out of the path of the debris is your best chance of survival. Now, the whole southwest corner thing happened because this, again, from the, in the 19th century, they observed that the characteristic pattern of a tornado moves from southwest to northeast,
right,
which is true. So they thought that if you were at that corner, the wind hitting you straight on would give you the construction of the building might give you more shelter. There again, there's no reason that's actually true, but it sounds nice. And one of the things you learn when you're researching the history of tornadoes is that people are always giving advice that has no real value, but it gives you a feeling like there's something you can do.
Yeah. You know, this is the time of year when these things tend to hit out here, as you well know. Why do these things, which terrify people out here so much, why did they interest you so much as a little boy, Lee?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, and so you're always aware of it. And the other thing, too, this is something that's very easy to forget now. I grew up in the 60s, and in the 60s, even a photograph of a tornado was a rare thing. You almost never saw them, and you certainly almost never saw the film of them. The whole video revolution has made them much more present and much more vivid, but maybe a little less mysterious. I mean, to me, when I was a kid, they were just intensely mysterious.
Yeah.
There were this terrifying thing that could come out of nowhere and destroy you, and no one even really knew what they looked like. So that was really where my fascination with them started.
Well, if they were intensely mysterious to you, as I mentioned in the introduction to the show, just imagine how mysterious they were to the earliest settlers to North America. What did they make of these things? Just how terrifying were these cyclones to the earliest folks who came to this continent, Lee?
Oh, they were absolutely baffled by them and terrified. You know, the first settlers saw them very occasionally on the East Coast. They're fairly rare outside of the Midwest.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the 19th century where there was a major movement into the Midwest that people began seeing them regularly. And they were astonished by them. They'd heard nothing about them. There was very little scientific information. The Native Americans knew about them, but the white settlers had no idea. And usually, of course, it was a very religious age. They thought of them as God's judgment, the finger of God, which was a phrase that you still hear used to describe some tornadoes. And that came up in the 19th century. That's what they looked like.
So this notion that there was the Storm King, you know, who was this mythological figure galloping through the night amid bolts of lightning. I mean, what an image. And that's what people thought. At least that's what some people thought.
Well, I don't know that they really took it that seriously, but that was a common idea that they had, you know, that came up. The earliest I was able to take it back was sometime in, like, the 1820s, where people started writing poems about them. I don't know whether anybody really believed it, but it is a pretty amazing image, isn't it?
The notion that they are natural phenomenon, that idea came along roughly when, chronologically?
Well, the first person to seriously investigate tornadoes was Benjamin Franklin. And
he chased one once, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was the first tornado chaser that we know about. he was traveling with some friends. They were riding on horseback through the Maryland countryside, and a small tornado formed ahead of them on the road. And everybody reared back in terror, except for Franklin, who rode after it. So that shows the urge to chase tornadoes is very old. According to one of his letters, you can believe it or not, it is Benjamin Franklin. I don't want to call him a liar. He was riding alongside of it, lashing it with his riding crop. So, you know, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. What did the Native Americans, what did they think about what tornadoes were, Lee? What was their explanation for them?
Well, they had a lot of practical wisdom built up about how to deal with tornadoes. They understood about getting, as I was mentioning earlier, about lying flat in the depression is the best way to avoid getting killed. So they had that. They had a lot of stories about tornadoes. They had a lot of folk tales. Every one of the nations out in the plains had its own legend, and that they were the product of sorcery or the product of some god, and they did tell those stories. How much they believed them, that's always the question with mythology. I mean, people tell the stories mostly to children, which is what they did. Whether they seriously believe them or not, I don't know. They had a lot of practical wisdom that was entirely wrong, too, which is part of the history of tornadoes. It's several hundred years of bad advice. They told the white settlers to build their settlements at the junction of rivers because tornadoes didn't cross water. Well, I mean, you're in St. Louis. It's the junction of the two greatest rivers in the Midwest,
right,
or in North America. And I think you can testify as to how good that advice was.
Yeah, exactly. And people even think today that tornadoes don't go through the middle of big cities. You hear that occasionally.
Yeah, you still do hear that idea. The idea being that the tall buildings break up tornadoes. But the tornadic storm is as tall as a thunderstorm itself. So it's talking about tens of thousands of feet high. So a skyscraper, no matter how tall, isn't going to make any difference. But that was certainly an idea. That in the 19th century, they believed the tornadoes wouldn't cut through forests, which is absurd because they had the track of the storms cut through forests in front of them. There was a National Weather Service guy in the late 19th century actually suggested setting piles of dynamite in front of them, blowing them up. That would be a way of stopping them.
You know, it is amazing, even in my own career, you know, covering these things, occasionally, I cover politics here, but occasionally you're dispatched to help cover a series of tornadoes out here that occur so frequently. You know, every year you have a little bit of that going on. But even, you know, I have such clear recollections of going into neighborhoods where those things, tornadoes have hit, and you come across one house that was totally intact, absolutely nothing amiss, and then the house right next door in the same cul-de-sac completely leveled, and that pattern would sort of continue in some ways, and you just almost couldn't believe it.
Yeah. There isn't a scientific explanation for it. Which I'll give you very briefly. People thought tornadoes used to rise and skip, which is why you saw the trail of damage you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But we now know that that's not true. But around the base of the funnel are these smaller, essentially kind of mini tornadoes. And there are a number of them that are circulating, and those are the ones that are causing the most intense damage. And because their pattern of movement around the base is irregular, it can come through a block and destroy 10 houses and leave one alone, because that one house just happened to be in the fluke area where these mini tornadoes weren't passing. And since they're so small, and so concentrated, so can cause such spectacular destruction and then leave one building alone.
And I gather, Lee, you can't see those little mini tornadoes with the naked eye?
No. You just basically see. In fact, their existence wasn't even really known until really about 20 or 30 years ago, when it was shown theoretically. And they're still very hard to detect, even with radar. And in fact, it's usually not known what their path was until people look at the damage trail afterwards, and then you can see it fairly clearly.
You know, people still have a hard time understanding. I do, you know, understanding exactly what these things are and how they're formed. You have a terrific analogy in your good book, again, the book Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers, an analogy that has to do with boiling water that helps explain how these things form. Walk us through that.
Sure. The basic thing that you have to understand what a tornado is it's a product of atmospheric instability. And it's caused when there is hot, humid air at the surface and cold, dry air aloft.
Mm.
And that is an inherently unstable relationship because, as we know, hot air rises.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly the same way that if you're boiling a pot of water on the stove, it starts heating up from the bottom. So you have hot water at the bottom and cold water at the top. And if you've ever watched a pot of water boil, the bubbles don't appear randomly. You start getting lines appear of bubbles going up from one particular spot.
Mm.
That's a phenomenon called convection. And a tornado, in effect, is the same way. A tornado is a small column rising just like the bubbles are rising in a pot of water. It's just rising much more quickly and powerfully from one specific spot. And it is a way that they heat at the bottom of the pan is moving to the top of the pan. It's a way for the hot air at the bottom of the atmosphere to rise to the upper air.
Hmm. Because you're saying hot air has to rise. That's its basic state. It has to go up.
Exactly. Exactly. And you can understand from the extraordinary violence of a tornado just how powerful that kind of energy is in the atmosphere. The tornado is actually measured by, I won't give you all the technical details, but it's called convective available potential energy. And that's the power of a tornado, is how much of that energy is available when this convection column starts to rise.
Mm-hmm. What does the word tornado mean exactly?
Well, there's a lot of dispute about that. It goes back to the 17th century. It's a Portuguese word that combines the ideas of turning and returning. And it was a term that British mariners started using for winds that arrived from different directions. So the word, in fact, was around long before anybody knew tornadoes existed.
Hmm. Now, tornadoes occur, I read in your book, on every continent except Antarctica.
Yeah.
Do I have that right? And they occur most frequently.
They're very rare almost everywhere else, but they have been demonstrated to occur there.
But they occur most frequently on this continent.
Yes.
Why is that?
It's a fluke of geography, really. What you need for tornadoes to form is this collision of these two air masses, the hot, humid air and the cold, dry air. And in the Great Plains and the prairies, you get the cold, dry air flowing down from Canada and the hot, moist air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. And you need both of those things to occur in large quantities. The only other place on Earth where that happens routinely, in fact, is on the Indian subcontinent in Bangladesh, where they have hot, humid air coming up from the Indian Ocean and cold air coming off the Himalayas. And they do have tornadoes in Bangladesh.
Hmm. Again, we're visiting with author Lee Sandlin and his new book, Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers. Let's hear from some of the storm chasers among our listeners out there. What do you hope to see, and how close are you willing to get when you see a tornado? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, Lee, tornadoes, of course, were central to The Wizard of Oz, movie and the book. And how accurate was the description of tornadoes by the author of The Wizard of Oz, Frank Baum?
Well, it wasn't very.
Not very, right.
Sketchy. I don't think he had really seen a tornado. But in the movie, the people who made the movie took a lot of care to get a tornado to look right. And they did pretty well. It doesn't move exactly like it does in the movie, but the look is just right. And for a lot of people, people certainly of my generation and older, that was the only clear look they ever got a tornado. So if they picture a tornado, they're picturing that one.
Yeah. Speaking of that book, tell us about the double tornado that tore through Irving, Kansas back in 1879. Such an interesting idea to me, a double tornado.
Well, there's a lot of dispute about that, but tornadoes can come in multiple funnels. There are sometimes when it's more than double, there are triple and quadruple tornadoes. Usually it's one strong one and several weak ones. What happened in Irving, Kansas was that two tornadoes passed in close succession. and one of which was looked like a regular tornado, and the second one was so strange looking. It looked like a moving mountain, and it was an extraordinarily powerful tornado. People glimpsed inside that there were, the, according to one eyewitness, this may or may not have been true, but the only witness who said that they saw the interior of the cloud said that there were two tornadoes moving side by side, cutting its way through the town. Hmm. And it left this extraordinary trail of devastation.
Yeah. Let's go to the heart of the matter here and talk a little more about the folks who figured out what these things were. We've already mentioned Benjamin Franklin. He wound up telling the Royal Society of London, no less, that tornadoes were upward rushing columns of air. How did he figure that out back in the day?
Well, he started actually from waterspouts. People did know about waterspouts because sailors had seen them. You can occasionally see them in the Mediterranean. And people thought, and in fact, I've discovered talking to people, people still have this idea that a waterspout is physically made out of water, which is actually impossible. Water is far too heavy. What looks like a column of water is, in fact, a cloud. And he was the first person to really work out the math of that and see that it was a rising column of hot air. And it occurred to him that if it wasn't made out of water, there was no particular reason it could only be observed over water and that it was possible that it would happen over land. So that was really where the start of the scientific awareness of tornadoes as a phenomenon was. In fact, Franklin called tornadoes. He didn't use the word tornado. He called them land spouts.
Hey, how did he figure that out, though? I mean, what kind of tools did he have available? You mentioned that.
Just his own head. He was an extraordinary person for coming up with brilliant ideas. Part of the frustration with Franklin when you read a lot about him is that he tended to come up with a stream of ideas on all kinds of subjects and then just toss them aside because he'd get bored. we think of Franklin as, you know, Mr. Steady, Mr. Responsible, because of Poor Richard's Almanac. And these are all kinds of ways in which he did believe all of that stuff, but he was kind of trying to lecture himself about stick to one thing.
Yeah.
He was really bad at sticking to one thing. So he went through this period of intense interest in the physics of electricity, and that led him to consider thunderstorms, which led him towards violent weather like waterspouts and tornadoes. And there was a period of 3 or 4 years when he was kind of obsessed with them and then kind of lost interest and moved on to the next thing.
That's interesting. Our guest again, Lee Sandlin, he's the author of Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers. Lee, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about the development of accurate weather forecasts and how accurate we are today at figuring out when and if these tornadoes are coming through our neck of the woods. I'm Steve Kraske at the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with author Lee Sandlin about tornadoes and his book, Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers. That book now out in paperback. If you just move forward a little bit, Lee, we get to the 1830s and an ex-school teacher from Kentucky named James Espy, who grasped that the air climbed by means of convection. And he figured that out how. He was talking about these columns of rising air that pumped warmth and humidity into the cold air aloft like pistons in a steam engine. How did he figure that out?
There again, a lot of this stuff, people in those days did thought experiments. They didn't have computers or a lot of hardcore mathematical data. He was just trying to figure out for himself how it was that the atmosphere worked. And he was the first person we know about who grasped, I've used this word convection a lot, but it comes up constantly when you're talking about tornadoes, but it's the power, the thing that powers the movement of the atmosphere and the vertical movement of the atmosphere. And he was the first person to imagine this whole, the atmosphere is a kind of machine, and his analogy for it was a steam engine. And he was entirely right about that. And he and that idea is still at the core of modern meteorology. He was wrong about a lot of the applications. The problem with Espy, as with a lot of scientists, is that he wasn't overly given to doubt about his own theories. And there were ideas that needed to be modified, and he wasn't interested in modifying them.
Then in the 1880s, a guy named Army Signal Corpsman John Park Finley came along. What was his contribution?
Well, Finley was the first person to try to predict tornadoes systematically. He was working for the Signal Corps, who at that time had taken over from the Smithsonian Institution the job of the National Weather Service. It was one of these things, the Signal Corps, they existed to do battlefield communications, but there were no wars then, so rather than disband as people wanted them to do, they decided to find a new thing to justify their existence, and so they volunteered to take over the Weather Service. And Finley was one of the people who was going around the country making field reports on tornadoes, which was the first time that this had happened, and this was when the Midwest became heavily settled, and people for the first time began to understand how common tornadoes were. Up until then, they really did not have any idea that tornadoes were a frequent occurrence. And so Finley began keeping systematic records of tornado touchdowns and tried to calculate for the first time what the conditions were that would be right for spawning tornadoes.
Your question,
a lot of his rules are still basic. His basic principles we're still following today.
Huh. Your questions about tornadoes, welcome. 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. So then how did accurate forecasts wind up getting developed, Lee? Because who was behind that and how did they develop? And I wanted to go to a story that all this was helped by a tornado that damaged an Air Force base in 1948 outside of Oklahoma City.
Yeah, Tinker Air Force Base.
Yes.
Well, of course, you could make the argument that we're still in the beginnings of getting accurate tornado forecasts. That's still a matter of considerable controversy as to how good the forecasting system really is. But serious progress in it didn't begin until after World War II. And the specific thing that happened at that air base was that they were storing this immense number of planes that had been left over from the war, and they were out in open fields, and a tornado had come through and had done this vast amount of damage. So the commander of the base kind of blithely said to the meteorologist there, figure out how to predict tornadoes, and you've got 3 days.
And what did he do?
Well, these two guys, Fallbush and Miller were their names.
Robert Miller and E.J. Fallbush, right.
Yes, exactly. Yes, they spent 3 sleepless days going through everything that had ever been published in terms of scientific research on tornadoes. And at the end of that time, they had not a predicting system, but they had rules of thumb, which they were able to use. Through a kind of an amazing stroke, there was a week later, there was the exact same conditions existed at that Air Force Base, and a tornado crossed the Air Force Base just as it had done before, except this time these guys had predicted it would happen, and they had time to get everybody into shelter and get the plane secured.
So they were seen as geniuses then, right? Because they got they got it right.
Yeah, the National Weather Service refused to accept it. They were a very conservative organization, but everybody else did. And what in fact happened was that the rumor started getting around the Midwest that the Air Force had a way of predicting tornadoes. And it happened because when they would issue these warnings, Fallbush and Miller, they would do them for just Air Force personnel on the bases. But because it's human nature, people on the bases would call their homes, call their parents, call their families and say, in the civilian world, and say there's a tornado coming. And that was how the news got around.
Boy, that's amazing. That's just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I was going to say, what's next year? So how do we get this measuring stick of a storm's destructive power that came about? I mean, I'm talking about the scale of F1 to F5.
Right. A meteorologist named Ted Fujita.
Right.
F is for Fujita. It's now been replaced by a system called the Enhanced Fujita Scale. So now we talk about EF5 rather than F5. But it's still basically the same idea. He was from Japan, and he came to America specifically because he was fascinated by tornadoes. And he began in the 50s to do serious research traveling around to tornado sites and collecting images of tornadoes. And he was the first person to try and work out systematically just how to rate that scale and how to rate tornadoes. And he was going by the aftermath, which is one of the things people don't really understand even now about that. You can't look at a tornado just as it's coming and say, oh, that's an EF3 or something. The numbers on that scale are a reflection of the damage it causes. So you can only judge what it is after the tornado has left, and you can see what kind of damage it did.
Hmm. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Matt from Kansas City, Kansas. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I had heard that there is a satellite either up or going up with a NOAA satellite with a lightning strike or lightning flash detector, and that detector, they think there might be a pattern to the lightning strikes that can help predict tornado location and movement. Can you tell me any more about that?
Lee, what about lightning strikes as an indicator?
Yeah, that has to do not so much with ground strikes, but with this strange phenomenon that's been seen of lightning appearing above storm clouds, which has only really been detected in the last few years. And that's still a very mysterious phenomenon, and it is possible that it is related to tornado formation. Because the key thing here is that we know a huge amount more about tornadoes than we did 10, 15 years ago even. But the core thing, the trigger event, the problem called tornado genesis, still is mysterious. And something like this, which is a mysterious phenomenon in storms, could be a way of determining what's happening in the upper atmosphere that could help trigger tornadoes. That's at least as far as I understand what the idea is, although there may be other specific stuff I haven't heard.
Well, Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You know, I've got to ask you, Lee, about the Joplin tornado in 2011.
Yeah.
You know, 160 people killed, the single deadliest American tornado in more than 60 years. Of that tornado, you write this in the book, everything about that professional response happened exactly as it was supposed to. Warnings went out 20 minutes before the tornado touched ground.
I have to interrupt here. Some people in Joplin strongly disagree with that, by the way. I heard after the book was published that they do not agree with the notion that everything happened the right way. So I want to footnote that I don't want that to be taken as the last word.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But some folks say warnings went out 20 minutes ahead of time. I mean, so
yeah.
Given that, you wonder why so many folks perished in that storm.
Well, I think that there's several factors. Among them, it was an extremely confusing and chaotic event. The tornado was not visible. It was a thing called a rain-wrapped tornado. So even when people, it was almost right on top of people, they couldn't see it. And I'm not going to take anything away from the good people of Joplin, but throughout the Midwest, I've discovered tornado awareness has been the preparations, what you're supposed to do in an emergency. That seems to be getting a little problematic. People don't know what the warning signs are, and they don't listen to warnings. This just happened in Chicago a couple of years ago. My wife happened to be standing on an elevated platform as a tornado warning siren went off. And of the 30 people on the platform, she was the only one who knew what that meant. She was the only one.
Ouch.
Ouch. And the other thing that is a major issue, and it was a major issue in Joplin, and this is something that I've seen firsthand because I've been traveling around the Midwest talking about this book. The Midwest is getting very overbuilt, and most of the new construction people are not thinking in terms of putting in storm shelters or storm cellars. Most big malls, for instance, there's no storm shelters in them, and if they are, they're not marked. People have no idea where to go if they were trying to take shelter.
Yeah.
And that's as the land gets more developed. There's going to be fewer and fewer places tornadoes can touch down without crossing into populated areas. So it's really getting to be a worrying thing that we're taking so little care about this.
Yeah. Well, Lee, hang on for a moment. I want to bring into our conversation now Scott Nicholson. He's with Spring Weather Productions out of Omaha, Nebraska. And this is a tour company that offers expeditions to Tornado Alley. And Scott, thanks for taking a minute with us. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Why do people want to do this?
Well, there is the thrill of the hunt to see a rare phenomenon that most people will not see, in their lifetime. It's to get up close and personal with something that's very destructive, yet it is absolutely a beautiful phenomenon that Mother Nature displays. To get close and see something so powerful, it's awe-striking. It's an unbelievable sight.
How often do your customers actually get to see a twister when you take them out? Because this is a pretty much of a hit and miss deal, isn't it?
It is. It's you can't control Mother Nature. We can only schedule our tours during the weeks when tornado probabilities are higher.
And that's right now, I gather, right?
Yeah, May and June are the best 2 months to chase. Mm. I schedule my tours for the last 2 weeks of May, and I just recently started offering tours to the public, and for the week-long tours, we have a 100% success rate, but we only just started chasing last year with guests in our vehicle.
Hmm. How does it work? I mean, how many guests do you take in a vehicle? What's in the vehicle, and where do you go?
We allow only up to 3 guests at a time in our vehicle for the week-long tours. We'd like to make it as comfortable as possible for everyone, because you are driving hundreds of miles a day to get to the storm and during the chase itself. So we want them to be as comfortable as possible. In the vehicle, we are equipped with a lot of high-tech equipment. Technology these days has advanced so far from when I first started chasing back in 2000, where you have laptops, iPads, iPhones, wireless internet connections.
Hmm.
If we're out of the internet area where we don't have access to the internet, we actually have an XM receiver to pull satellite data down, so we can actually observe weather data through our laptop. Of course, we have our GPS units. We have 3 or 4 GPS units in case one breaks down, and we have our maps and all sorts of camera equipment.
Which parts of the country, are the best for storm production? Where do you go to increase the likelihood you're actually going to see something?
We will travel anywhere where the storms are, from North Dakota all the way down to Texas, Colorado to Illinois. But the prime areas are from pretty much northern Texas to Nebraska. That's part of the hot spot that people refer to as Tornado Alley.
Yeah. And you have an orientation the night before the chase. What happens there?
It's like a meet and greet where the guests come out and they meet each of the tour advisors. I'm the driver and navigator as well as one other person who's navigating and driving as well. So we all get to know each other, and then I will go through a kind of like a orientation on what we do as a company, our goals as a business, and as far as keeping the public safe. I also do a training orientation on how what to expect during the chase and what to do in case we need to take swift action.
Yeah, yeah. Lee, what do you make of all this? This notion that people actually pay money to hop in a car and drive hundreds of miles looking for these things. What do you make of it?
Well, as I say, and as your chaser just said, I mean, they are astonishing to see from close up. It's perfectly understandable to me why people would devote their lives to doing it. I'm a little too timid now to consider doing it myself. The last storm I chased, which was 25 years ago, way before any of this other stuff happened, I stopped because I was just literally became too afraid of the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, in fact, spawn an EF5 tornado. And I just thought, what am I doing? I could get killed.
Mm-hmm.
But the drama of it, I mean, there really is nothing in nature to compare with the sight of a tornado on the ground. There really isn't. They're just astonishing sights.
Scott Nicholson with Spring Weather Productions, Omaha, Nebraska. What is a weekend cost? If I want to come up for a Saturday and Sunday, what do you charge me for that?
Actually, I offer one-day tours. So we can go out on a day where there is a high potential to see severe weather and tornadoes. If that would be about $300 for that one day. Mm-hmm. I offer a membership service where people can come on an email list and I could send out information as to where I'm going to be so I can virtually almost pick them up wherever they are and go out and chasing in that in their area. And there's up to a 45% discount off those, the one-day tours.
Hey, have you ever had a situation where you had to sort of bail out of the vehicle and hop in the ditch, Scott, just to make sure that you were going to survive a storm?
No, in my 14 years of experience, I've never come across that. Safety is our number one priority. We would, if we have to give up a tornado to live and see another one, we'll do that. There will be more storms in the future, more tornadoes to see. We will not put our lives at risk to for a tornado. It's not worth it.
How close have you gotten to one yourself, whether you were on a tour or not?
The closest one I've gotten to was back in 2009, June 17th, the Aurora, Nebraska tornado. I was on Highway 34 as the tornado dropped behind me about less than a mile away, and that tornado happened to head to the south and east of me. As it was coming back to the north and east, I followed it east and got to about a block away from the tornado.
Oh, my gosh.
About a quarter mile wide tornado.
And you saw and heard what at that point, Scott?
It was a very dusty tornado, so I did not hear what people referred to as the terrain because I was in my vehicle. But but it was a very dusty, tornado, so it looked more ominous than what it probably really was.
Yeah.
The reason why I was able to get so close is because the tornado itself was actually moving pretty slowly.
Yeah. Well, Scott Nicholson with Spring Weather Productions out of Omaha, thank you for your time today. So good to have you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And Lee Sandlin, author of Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers. What a great conversation, Lee. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks so much.